I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast, and I'd like to take this small bit of time out of your listening to ask you to support the Cato Institute and the Cato Daily Podcast by becoming a podcast sponsor. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and give a donation in any amount to support our work. If you donate $1,000 before the end of the year, I'll give you a shout-out on the podcast. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to get started. You can also designate a friend or loved one to receive the benefits of being a Cato sponsor. Thank you for supporting the Cato Institute and the values of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 25th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. What does Stoicism have to offer in our current political climate? How can we focus on what we know matters in a time of potentially infinite distractions? What parallels are there between the philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth and the great Stoic Seneca? Ryan Holiday is author of several books on the Stoic philosophy. We spoke last week about remaining engaged with what matters while not getting mired in events and conflicts that we don't control. Friedrich Hayek, who is much appreciated by people here at the Cato Institute a long time ago, said, "The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design." And I think the broader point for a lot of people who cherish liberty and have, let's say, more than a healthy skepticism toward government are people who are sort of banging their heads against the wall trying to convince their friends that, oh, your vote doesn't matter. You should just try to be happy and not worry about these policy outcomes. And of course, here I'm working at a think tank, and that's what we do all day is try to convince people to do this versus that. So I feel like I'm being pulled in two directions. But in general, when it comes to people engaging with the news, with the economy, with politics, how do we separate the things that we can control from what we cannot control?
That's the trillion-dollar question, I guess. I mean, I think what people forget is that the news business is not in the business of making the world a better place. It's not a business of communicating truth to you. It's the business of getting you stuck to your computer screen or your television so they can get you to sit through commercials, right? And so people have come to sort of conflate paying attention to things with making a difference. And this idea that the citizen of a democracy or a republic should be informed has become expanded to the idea that we should be monitoring everything that's going on at all times. And what I think this has actually done is it's made us exhausted. It's made us very jaded and cynical. And it's actually sucked away all the time and energy that we might have to vote, to convince a neighbor or a friend or another person who feels differently than us to come over to our side. It's also created, I know way too much about Brexit for someone who's not a citizen of the EU or the UK. Meanwhile, I don't actually know that much about what goes on in the small town that I live in. And so this is all a roundabout way of saying what I think the Stoic does is that by narrowing our viewpoint, by shrinking from our concern, a lot of things that we don't have a ton of influence over. This isn't about producing apathy. It's not the idea that ignorance is bliss, but it's a resource allocation issue. And the Stoics are trying to stop sending. It's like, let's stop exporting foreign aid, to use an analogy or a metaphor here, and focus on some infrastructure improvements at home. I think that's really what the Stoic mindset is about.
In watching news, and you say you know too much about Brexit, so you're obviously following the news. Is there anything that a Stoic would look at, say, the electorate of 2016 or 2018, and either take heart or draw something away from and sort of have sort of a down opinion about them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And look, one of the reasons I know about Brexit is because if you travel through an airport in this country, you are literally being, just another news example. The airport television, the televisions in airports play CNN, not because that's the best news channel, but that's CNN has a deal with like 50 of the major airports in the United States to pay them to play CNN all the time. And it's actually an edited version of CNN that doesn't show airplane crashes or other gruesome things. It basically just shows you a nonstop parade of nonsense opinions and fear mongering and other ridiculous things. Right. So it's hard not, it almost requires more discipline to not watch the news than to watch the news in 2018. As far as 2016, I mean, I would say, you know, one of my favorite pieces of Stoic advice from Seneca is that nothing happens to the wise man contrary to his expectation. Basically that the true philosopher takes a bigger picture view, sort of steps back, sees what other people are not seeing. The fact that 2016 was a surprise to so many people, myself included, I think is an indictment. Whether you think the outcome that happened should have happened, why it happened, whether you want to get into Russian conspiracy theories or, you know, perhaps, you know, very real evidence of Russian interference in the election, that no one could conceive of an outcome that was clearly much more likely than we would have thought, I think is a sort of an indictment of how often we see the world as we want it to be, not as it actually is, and that we don't do a lot of the difficult work of thinking in advance, you know, how Murphy's Law can happen or how things can surprise or catch us off guard. And so I think one of the things I would take from that election is just that we have to do a better job being prepared for surprises. I guess one of the things I personally take from the election, and again, not to make a political, I think this is beyond politics, it's more in the sort of the kind of world that we want to live in. I guess I'm dismayed by the sort of the normalization of sort of lying and cruelty and sort of abuse on both sides of the aisle. I'm alarmed at this sort of, again, whether how real it is, I guess remains to be seen, but this sort of the reemergence of really sort of extremely toxic, negative, racist, angry, you know, viewpoints that have sort of re-entered the public sphere. I mean, to me as a parent and as a person who tries to be a good person, that's not something I like seeing. I guess the Stoic response to that would be, look, humans are not the nicest animal, and we never have been. And you know, this is an opportunity for individuals to sort of stand up against what might be a sort of a rising tide of bad things.
One of the quotes that you point to is that anger brings about nothing grand or beautiful. This is from Seneca. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, to be constantly irritated seems to me to be the part of a languid and unhappy mind conscious of its own feebleness. That is, people who are angry are sort of impotently so.
Yeah, look, there's that saying, you see it now, particularly in liberal circles, where it's like, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention, which I just love, because if you're outraged, you're probably paying too close attention. You're probably too concerned with what's happening right now and not taking a long enough view. And I also tend to find that people who are I think the Stoics would agree that anger is bad fuel. It might get things done in the short term, but it tends to have a lot of unintended consequences. It tends to be pretty sloppy. It tends to ultimately end up feeding upon itself. And so I just don't like this idea that, you know, okay, one side of the aisle is angry. the way to beat them at the ballot box is to make your side even angrier. I'm not sure. I think you know, Cato was a lover of rational thought. It was all about being rational and disciplined and in control of oneself. And it strikes me that that's something that that smart people are abandoning. And I'm not sure it's for their benefit.
Well, yeah, we hear a lot about tribalism, and it seems at least to me that tribalism is just a natural state, and that overcoming that is the work of the mind.
I think that's exactly right. You know, you also see. You see how tribalism begets tribalism, right? Like, so you can see how, like, I think it's fascinating. It's probably a little politically incorrect to say, but it's interesting to me. I don't remember a few years ago white people talking about being white as much as they talk about it. I'm not actually saying, like, on the sort of alt-right side of things, like white power and white nationalism. I'm saying, like, normal, even left-leaning people that I know talk about how, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want another white guy opining in on this. Like you could see how the tribalism has almost recreated whiteness as a tribe on both in sort of a self-flagellating way, but then on the more extreme end, like sort of embracing the identity and creating sort of white identity politics. And so it's what I think that we're really talking about is that when you see someone else engaging in tribalism, someone else destroying norms, someone else behaving angrily or irrationally, I think what this situation really calls for is increased self-discipline and self-control. So again, to make a political argument, there's a lot of people and some smart people I know have written about this. It's okay, the Republicans are destroying some of the unwritten norms of our governmental system. So they are advocating the destruction of more norms to combat those norms. Like you could see, so Trump is going along and destroying various sort of norms, whether it's nepotism or, you know, respecting the Department of Justice or whatever. But then you pull up Twitter and you see journalists violating the norms of their profession flagrantly so. And it's hard. It becomes sort of this negative feedback loop where no one is sticking to principle and no one is saying, hey, this is the way things are supposed to be, so I'm going to behave that way, even if other people aren't. And you get into chaos and disorder and tribalism very quickly from there.
So for people who are interested in politics, and, you know, as Ayn Rand famously said, I'm interested in politics so that one day I might not have to be interested in politics.
Sure.
But the for those people who pay attention to this and want to have influence, a positive influence, and yet don't want to check themselves against being dragged into these sort of tribal fights and these sort of wedge issue fights that are largely meaningless in terms of how we get along with one another on an individual basis. What are the things that we need to do in order to keep ourselves from getting, you know, trapped in a box to the point at which, well, we don't even know we're in the box?
Sure. I mean, look, one of the reasons that I think our affinity for Stoicism is there and why we're talking about it is that it's of all the philosophies, you know, whether we're talking about Buddhism or Epicureanism or Christianity or Hinduism, religions and philosophies, Stoicism is the most overtly political, right? Marcus Aurelius is the emperor of Rome. Seneca is basically the sort of the top political aide and strategist for the emperor. Cato, of course, dies attempting to preserve the Roman Republic. The founding fathers of the United States were avid students of Stoicism. George Washington puts on a play about Cato at Valley Forge. Stoicism was designed to be this philosophy for the public man, and now we'd say public woman, who is out there in the arena, who is out there trying to do the right thing amidst the temptations and the trappings of power, amidst the criticism, emanating from the audience, the reality of compromise and man's imperfection, you know, our own tempers, our own ambitions. It's hard for me to say much more than like, look, go read these books by people who were experiencing the exact same struggle that we are facing now. And listen to them. I mean, there's a line from, to go to the news conversation, there's a line from Epictetus where he says, if you wish to improve, be content to be seen as ignorant or unknowledgeable about superfluous things. There's a line from Marcus Aurelius where he talks about being distracted by breaking news. And now that's a modern idiom, but I think he was referring then to news from the front and messengers and gossip from the court, right? And so none of the things that we're dealing with are particularly new. They're just exacerbated and taken to their extremes through social media and 24/7, 365 media. But none of the things that we're dealing with are particularly new. I mean, the mob mentality that we see now, I mean, who do you think killed Socrates, right? And so this is how humanity has always been. It just happens that we've slowly forgotten about or ignored the toolkit that we came up with to help us manage all of it.
Yeah, it's very easy to point fingers about tribalism and civility when you're not willing to recognize any of those impulses within yourself.
Yeah, and look, tribalism is obviously not great, and it's certainly happening now. But I would rather live in today's tribalized society than in one where the empire decided that everyone beyond its borders was a barbarian who you could kill without impunity, right? And so it's also, I think, what the Stoic does is it sort of zooms out, you know, gets above, and it goes, look, things are not great. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot of room for progress, but it's hard to deny. It's hard to deny that we're not making progress, and it's hard to deny. It's hard to seriously claim that things are worse in 2018 than they've been in basically any point in history.
And yet that is an eternal struggle. I know in Cato, we have a project here called humanprogress.org where we generally produce positive news about the trends of humanity over the last decades or 100 years. And yet we all have this natural bias to reject a lot of that information, or at least make it, put it in the back of our minds rather than the front.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the strongest predictor of virality that we've seen on the internet, like sort of the most viral emotion, is anger. There are certainly sort of gooey, saccharine news stories that spread, but it's hard to get people to go, hey, you know, things are generally pretty good. Let's relax. That's not super viral. Can you believe that Trump just said these countries are shitholes? You know, that's much more viral and immediate, even though it's ultimately pretty meaningless. And so it's not just our personal inclinations, but it's also the mechanisms of the medium and the tools that we use that sort of hyper-exaggerate that stuff. It's like, what's that line from Men in Black where it's like a person can be smart, but people are stupid? You know, the internet makes us into this giant hive mind sort of crowd that just does what irrational mobs have always done since, you know, the first group of people ever got together with pitchforks. And then we wonder why we're upset and miserable and think everything's awful.
So I'll ask this again. We're always sort of circling around some of the similar questions here.
Yeah.
For people who want to be engaged and be connected, how do they do that without trapping themselves in that sort of tribalism that, or not just tribalism, of just, you know, either taking a very narrow view or a very small view of the world, or, you know, focusing to the exclusion of all else on things like politics or electoral outcomes or even their own stock portfolios.
Sure. Yeah, you know, Seneca is an interesting example of all this because he ends up participating quite actively in national politics. He thinks that that's where he's going to have the most impact on the world. He's I'm going to go to the center of power. I'm going to be right there. I'm going to have as much impact as I can. And he ends up being assigned to tutor a young prince named Nero. And he basically, sort of rides all the way up with Nero until Nero becomes emperor. And he's trying basically to rein in the excesses of Nero and is not particularly successful. He ends up bouncing out. But then he writes this essay after he leaves, and you could tell he can't quite come to it, but he gets close. And he's basically saying that our obligation as philosophers and people is to be of use to our fellow man. But he's basically questioning whether you have to do that at the state level, if you have to do it at the national level, or if there are other ways to do it. And I think he's basically realizing, like, oh, wait, I can have enormous impact as a writer. I can even reach people beyond Rome. I can reach all of history and neighboring countries and so on and so forth. And I'm not so nearly so morally compromised as I was, you know, being complicit with this tyrant. And so I think that's one of the things that people should think about. I'm not to say that no one should participate in politics, because you could argue maybe our problem is that only bad people are participating in politics these days in terms of running for office. But I guess what I'm saying is I would encourage people who are frustrated with the state of the world to participate at the local level, the regional level, where they can have the most immediate impact. Like, how many people are complaining about Trump, but they don't know the names of their neighbors, right? Who bemoan the tribalization and polarization of society, but could easily run for and serve on a local school board and have a real impact right now. And so that's something that, you know, I think about. There's a line in Unbearable Lightness of Meaning that I've been thinking about, and this is after the communists take over the country in the end. There's a woman, she's saving this dead crow or this dying crow by the side of the road, and she says, you know, saving a half-buried crow on the side of the road is more meaningful than sending a petition to the president. And I just love that. And I thought it's sort of an indictment of our time, too, which is that we are, again, way too concerned with whether Britain should stay in the European Union, which we don't have a say in at all, and much less involved or present or aware of, you know, what they're teaching in our children's school, or agreeing to volunteer in our children's school, or, you know, to help out a neighbor whose car is stuck in the mud. And so I think one of the things I would urge people to do would be to participate and be active, but it can take a variety of forms, I guess is what I'm saying.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. This is going to go out Christmas Day.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for having me.
And I will, I'll be in touch next year as well.
All right. I would love that.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Oh, wait. Actually, you're still there?
Yes.
I don't know if it's worth saying, but I just wrote a piece about this too. I think it's pretty incredible we're knocking on the door of Christmas here. Seneca and Jesus were born in the same year, not the same day, but it's also incredible to me that these two philosophers walked the earth at the same time and basically lived parallel lives.
Yeah. Can we want to make a reference to that?
If you want me to, I don't
sure,
know.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
something
yeah.
I was
yeah.
thinking about.
Okay, we're still rolling. Okay, so before we started recording, you noted that Jesus and Seneca pretty much walked the earth at the same time, and you draw parallels between their lives. What What parallels do you draw? Why? And what do you think is the significance of that?
Well, it is incredible that these sort of two philosophers, are, as far as we know, they're born in the same year. We don't know when either of them was born for certain, but like both are mentioned in Tacitus. Christ is Christus, and Seneca is Seneca in Tacitus. Seneca's brother actually appears in the Bible, which is pretty unbelievable. There's a fake letter between Seneca and St. Paul. But they were alive at the same time. Both were, you know, real human beings. One claimed to be the son of God. The other just claimed to be a regular person. But they're both human beings who walked the earth. Both died tragically at the sort of the hands of the same sort of tyrannical regime. And they both preached more or less very similar philosophies. I mean, you know, Jesus says, don't sin or you'll go to hell. Seneca says, you know, don't sin or your life will be hell. But they're basically saying the same thing. I mean, there's even this wonderful, you know, Jesus talks about, the speck in your neighbor's eye when there's a plank in your own. You know, Seneca uses almost the exact same metaphor. He says, you know, you point out the pimples on your neighbor when you are covered in sores.
I'm thinking of do not conform yourselves to the patterns of this world.
Yeah, it's just so wonderful that these two people were alive at the same time. They both passed on a legacy to us of not just philosophy, but also attempting to struggle with and live that philosophy. And to me, you know, it's Christmas. The ultimate blessing is that the legacy of these two men survives, you know, well beyond their deaths, you know, now down to us 2,000 years later. To me, that's a real Christmas miracle.
Ryan Holiday is author of Ego is the Enemy, The Obstacle is the Way, The Daily Stoic, and most recently, Conspiracy. It is almost 2019, and I'd like to ask you to consider supporting the Cato Podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by joining our podcast sponsor program. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and learn more of the benefits of sponsorship. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor.